We come to the end of the Christmas season. And over the past almost 2 weeks' time, the church has placed before us a variety of images, a variety of scenes, stories. All of them have to do with this child. And all of them, in some way, carry contradictions. In this story, from the Gospel according to Matthew, we find contradictions with regard to persons, contradictions with regard to places, and contradictions with regard to emotional response. In the first hand, we have three wise men, three people coming from the East, seeking the truth, seeking an answer, following a star and desiring to know where it leads and to whom it brings them. They are truth seekers. On the other hand, we have Herod. Herod has the entire history of the Israelite nation at his disposal. He has the full availability of the law and the prophets. The truth is there for him, and yet he closes himself off from that. He refuses to accept that. He refuses to embrace the truth. He avoids it. The one who should know the truth doesn't. And the ones who have no reason to know it search for it. The second seeming contradiction is the locale. You've got the great metropolitan city of Jerusalem, the center of culture and commerce and government. And then you've got that simple, almost hidden, inconspicuous little town called Bethlehem. And where one might expect that God would choose the great and the mighty city to be the place in which he touches down in human life, the contradiction is that the Creator of the universe chooses what is small and hidden and seemingly insignificant. And thirdly, the response, the attitude. When those wise men see the star come to its rest over the house, we're told that they're filled with joy, filled with anticipation, filled with excitement, as they go in and they find the child and his mother. On the other hand, Herod is filled with fear. He's filled with anxiety. And not only Herod, but all of Jerusalem, we're told, is frightened. And that I find puzzling. I can understand why Herod would be frightened. He's just been told that there is a pretender to the throne. He's just been told that his power is in jeopardy. He's just been told that there is a newborn king. He has a reason to be afraid. But why do all the inhabitants of Jerusalem fear? One would think that they would be delighted to know that there is a new king, for Herod was remarkable for his cruelty and the oppressive way in which he treated the citizens. This would be an opportunity for something new. And yet what seems to play out is that where there is a dominance of power, there is also a willingness to succumb. What had happened is that those residents of Jerusalem had made accommodation. They had found a way to live. They had adopted a passivity. They were able to carry on their daily lives even in the midst of the oppression that they found around themselves. They arrived at some level of comfort, at some level of satisfaction. And there was no desire to upset that. There was no desire to break away the accommodation that they'd worked out. That as bad as Herod was, they could live with that. They didn't want to risk living with something else. So there wasn't one of them, not one of them, in the story, followed along with those wise men as they followed the star and as they searched for this new king. The power of passivity held the inhabitants of Jerusalem captive. Now, I would suggest to you that that is the paradigm for all of civilization, all of human history. That where there is a dominant power, what issues is a spirit of passivity, a spirit of accommodation. This happened over and over in the scriptures. As much as the people of Israel were persecuted as slaves in Egypt, once they were brought into the desert, they longed to go back because they found their accommodation to slavery to be less difficult than their struggle with freedom. Within the past couple weeks, reflecting on this dominance, Benedict has written, and he said, there is a specter that moves among us. And not many of us see it clearly. Now, we're not dealing with a phantom of bygone years. This is something relatively new. This is a completely mechanized society whose only purpose is the maximum material production and the maximum consumption. This new dominant power is the deceitful accomplice of the slaughter of countless innocent persons. It has a variety of names, yet in every form that it appears, it is linked to a kind of life organization, to a kind of culture, which all of us bear in one way or another, and which has a common denominator, and that is the purely material view of existence. That Western society really measures existence almost exclusively in material terms. That that's where the values are. Now, that philosophy, he suggests, stifles and kills every search for truth, cancels every deep enthusiasm, is nourished only by ephemeral sensations, discourages sacrifice, laughs at graciousness and generosity, and encourages violence. He suggests that kind of materialism connives with every suppression of life which appears to stand against the cult of my private interest. So that my well-being, my security, my consumption, my acquisition, my having more is all that counts. And then he closes by saying the particular evil that is shown by this is that it often cloaks itself with the appearance of piety and religion. When there is a dominant culture, that dominant culture has the effect that it creates a passivity, an acceptance. One does not fight against it. One learns to accommodate to it. And as a result, one cannot see clearly the other opportunities that are present. Because to see those opportunities, one flirts with accepting them. And in accepting them, one flirts with overturning life as I know it. And that becomes difficult. And yet the message of the Christmas story, from the very beginning to the end, the message of the Christmas story is that God in the Incarnation turns human life upside down. That what is expected is not what happens. That business as usual is not what takes place. That what the world regards as unimportant becomes very important. And what human beings would accept as being absolute becomes insignificant. That there is a turning upside down that happens. Now the wise men coming from the east are the closing figures of the Christmas story. They are drawn by a star. They are brought by hope and promise. They leave behind what is known, and they have the courage to embark, to embrace what they do not know. And they do that not with fear, but with joy. They do that with expectation and with desire. And all of this upheaval that the story talks about, the larger Christmas story, all of that upheaval is because of a baby, because of an infant, because of a weak, newborn child. That the infant becomes the paradigm for God's plan. The upside-down plan of God. That it is the weakness of the infant that will challenge the strength of a society. That it is the simplicity of the infant who will ultimately challenge the grandiosity of a society. It is the humility of the infant that will pull down the pride of a society. And that in that infant, God once and for all has entered human history. And that human history cannot be understood apart from that intervention. and that any attempt on the part of men and women to excise or to remove God from human history is nothing more than the effort to degrade and denigrate the human person. For the very intervention of God in human history is the affirmation of the eternal value of human life and human beings. Never more profoundly expressed as in the unbelievable use of an infant, of a newborn baby, in whose life is the hope of a world. Well, as we come to the end of the Christmas season, the Feast of the Epiphany, seeks to draw all those strands together and to say to us, in effect, that this season is not a season about nostalgia. It is not a season about sentimentality. This season is fundamentally a season about God turning our lives upside down and inside out. And the challenge is then for us, in the image of those wise men, to see the star, to embrace the light, and to follow where it may lead.